I realized last time we didn't introduce, because we have, well, one new person, one return person. Why don't we just go around and say who we are?
Kathy. Sandy.
Barbara.
Ann.
Austin.
Patty.
Joram.
Carol.
I'm Gary. So, welcome back, everybody. As I said, I really don't know what I'm doing. So, I thought, let's try something a little different this time. What we did last time, which was, I think, confusing a little bit, was we went from the Red Book to how I at least feel Jung took these very primal imaginations and worked them into his psychology. I thought, why don't I start with the psychology and give you some of the basics of his later thinking, which these works are seeds of. I think knowing the end point will make understanding the beginning point a little easier. So that's what I thought I would do for at least for a while. For when I read something, I think, my gosh, that's the intuition, or that's the dialogue that Jung later extrapolated into a work. I'll go to the work first. We'll talk about it. And that's what I've typed up. You should have. We passed it out last time.
No, yeah, I'm not.
Oh.
When Kathy and Carol, and sometimes Sandy, when they answer or talk to you, I can't hear because they're looking at you. And could you repeat what they say? Or
I can hear, so maybe if you want to address the group, don't worry about me.
Okay. Great.
Any other details?
Can you hear over this okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, I noticed on the recording, it's like people sitting down there, I couldn't hear as well.
Yeah.
Too.
Does everyone agree that's the best place? We were trying to decide whether to put the picture there or to put the picture over there.
It's not as big.
Well, if we do put it there, I don't mind turning around for one.
But the fact that it's not as big could be the projector.
Oh, really?
I bet. I think what we'll do next time, Kathy's going to bring a little stand, and I'll have some extension cords, so we can move the projector back to get it at least full screen.
Okay.
That's going to be big enough, I think, if we get it full screen.
I think so, and you can't change the size.
That's as big as it gets.
Oh.
The only nice thing about there is it takes up less table space.
Putting the projector there.
We just had one person, you know, we only had,
we only around, so somebody
one
second turn around.
One rubs the seat.
It's just
bigger.
Yeah, it just makes it, if Tammy were here, it just makes it a little hard.
So you think it's better to put it on the wall?
And
or to put it over there?
Too, so you get two people that are brought in today, at least. I think it's hard to sit over there, which I did last week. It was hard to sit and turn and write at the same time. So this is easier for me, but of course I'm in a good place.
But if some of you guys needed, if we put it on the wall, if somebody said to me to be on this side, I'd be on
this. Yeah, I would sit on that side.
It'd be easier for me.
So are we saying the wall's better? The wall side's better?
Well, do you want
point, I mean, we can do it both ways, huh?
At the break?
Well, let's not mess with it. But set it up next time.
Yes, we can tighten up a lot more.
Tighten up a lot more than we are. Well, I know that there's a lot of space here.
So, we'll leave it there today. We'll try it over there next time, and we'll see how you feel.
I'm happy to sit on this side.
I am too.
I'll sit on that side.
Well,
I'm happy to sit on this side.
Okay.
The place.
Okay. Alrighty.
I have to tell you one thing. I was telling a friend that we got through one page.
We got through two sentences.
She said, oh, I know what you're going to do for the rest of your life.
Yeah, we'll finish this up at Marquette Manor.
We all just have to agree to be there.
Yeah.
And we'll have started our own little commune.
Oh, that's right.
There you go. Our own retirement village.
Our own retirement village. We'll literally have a young center.
Only none of us will know we're there.
And I get the same lesson every week, and nobody will remember. I just have to prepare one class. So you heard me say a friend of mine used to supervise with Liliana Fry Young when she was, must have been close to 90. And every time he walked in, she'd say, I don't believe we met. And she didn't remember him, but she remembered the case, which was interesting. So they would, they had to introduce themselves before every hour, and then, oh yes, now I remember. And then they would say, still at that age, was very sharp with material, but she didn't remember him.
They say that's one of the good things about Alzheimer's is you get to meet new people all the every day. You can hide your own Easter eggs.
You asked Nancy how old she was. I think almost 90 at the time. Yeah, I think so. So I thought what we'd start with today is the ideas that are surfacing in raw form in the text. And hopefully that will make understanding the text a little easier. So if you go to that photocopy I gave you guys last time. Yeah. What's happening is, remember the time frame. We talked about that. He talked about the four periods of Jung's life, this being the second. And the time frame, which is very important, is just before the outbreak of World War I. Where the world was still in the gay 90s, you might say. But in Jung's unconscious, there was warnings of war. So he talks about the spirit of the times, which was how people saw life, what the understanding of events was at that time, versus the understanding in his unconscious that there was a war coming. Welcome to the collective unconscious. The collective unconscious is that part of our unconscious that is aware not of us as persons, but of the nature of our times. Really, what's really going on. Just like we can deceive ourselves personally about who we are, and the unconscious shows us who we really are, the collective unconscious has a commentary to the historical period apart from the way it is normatively understood. One of the things then that happened after World War I, which Jung mentions in many places, is the loss of belief in God. How could God let, I don't know how many were killed in World War I, 54 million were killed in World War II. Think about that. That's 54 Indianapolises. In one battle in Russia alone, 5 million were killed. So both after World War I and World War II, I would say the sensitive souls said, how this doesn't fit. This idea of the protecting God and mass carnage does not work. And certainly to my feeling, that is a valid statement. I think if you listen to theological talk, most of it ignores that. And they're still blabbering on about the goodness of God, and it is not sustainable. So one of the things that's going on in Jung's unconscious is, okay, if that is if that's the reality, and if that's so directly contradicts our religious views. Is there no God? That was the contemporary response in Europe, European philosophy at the time. And Jung is going to say, that is not an answer. There is a God. But we have to re-understand what the nature of God is. And I think a lot of his work is attempting to address that question. And he provides an answer, I feel. What we'll look at, probably today at least, is what are the features of his answer, and then we can go to the text and see. That is the first thing that came up in his imagination, was the answer to the destruction and an answer to the so-called death of God. The first thing to understand, I think, about Jung's position is where he starts philosophically. His first criticism of traditional theology is that it confuses knowledge and experience. We've talked about this before. Some of you have heard it. Bear with me, because some haven't heard it. The argument based on the philosophy of Immanuel Kant goes something like this. An ant could not know me. That's a dimension of the very small to the very large. The dimensions of the finite to the infinite are just that, infinite. So how can a human being know God, just like how can an ant know me? So the first thing that Kant says, and Jung follows, there is no such thing as metaphysical knowledge. That is not to say there isn't metaphysical experience. The ant experiences me. I experience God. But the sticking point is that experience knowledge of what is known? Jung's answer is, Kant's answer is, no. That's the first big answer, I think, Jung goes. So that all of religion, all of theology, is the human imagination. It says this is the nature of God, but Jung's position is no. It is the nature of a human imagination working with human experience, which then imputes its understanding to the object understood. That's how he can look at theology and simply say, it's all wrong. God is not what you have said God is. God, what you have said God is your fantasy, your perception of what God is. So, who says God has to be good? You. God doesn't say God has to be good. So the horror that followed from the theology that says God is good, which then destroys the idea that God is good, kills God, because God doesn't fit, the reality of life doesn't fit the conjecture that has been made concerning what God is. Does that make sense? Here's how Jung put it. And so, indeed it is, for here that threshold which separates two epochs plays the principal role. I mean by that threshold the theory of knowledge whose starting point is Kant. On that threshold, minds go their separate ways, those who have understood Kant and others that cannot follow him. So, as far as Jung's concerned, the entire corpus of a lot of theology, at least, is based on this error. It thinks in describing God that it has described God, where what it is describing is its perception of God, which is based on the human process of understanding. So that he's never doubting the existence of God, but he's saying all statements of God are psychological. Can you see why that's so important? Because it was the picture of God that conflicted with reality that led people to say, God is dead. And Jung is saying, the problem isn't the reality. The problem is your picture of God is your picture of life. And just because your picture of life doesn't fit reality doesn't mean God doesn't exist. So he acknowledges the inadequacy of the previous views of God, but he also refuses to throw out God. And that's how he does it.
Those were all Tammy's questions last week. She's not here.
Well, that's really kind of why I went into it, because I felt... couldn't hear.
I'm sorry. I said those were all Tammy's questions last week. It's too bad she's not here.
Well, she can listen to it. It'll be on the web. All this is up on the web, you know, if you want to listen to it. jgsparks.net/audio. There's no link from my homepage, because I just keep it for the family. Crazy family. jgsparks.net and then /audio. And I put them up there every week, and they're up there for 2 weeks. You can download them, keep them, or whatever. They're MP3 files.
Don't take the last week off yet. I'm still trying to teach myself. I've done it before.
Oh.
I've downloaded yours before, but for some reason, I couldn't get it down.
If you got a PC, you should be able to right-click on the letter. Mm-hmm. It should come up, save as, or save target as, and then it should download. It doesn't work.
Downloads. I just can't get it from the download to CD.
Oh, that's it won't go to a CD. Well, it will go to a CD, but it won't turn into a CD you can put into a CD player unless you have a very specific CD player.
Okay.
With a new car, you might. If you make a CD with it, you make a data CD, not an audio CD.
Okay, maybe that's it.
You make a data CD, and only the newest. Like my car will play it, but my home players won't play it. It's got to be made in the last year or two for it to work. Otherwise, you have to listen on your computer or. You can put it on an iPod.
That's great. That's why I thought I wanted an iPod for my birthday.
Yeah.
And then you can play in the car.
Yeah.
Okay, which is great. Okay.
Well, your car, I'm sure you can sing, but try burning it as a data file. If you want to review it, and really, this is kind of for Tammy. So if you're listening,
we miss you.
And so if that's really the starting point, and that's going to come out here pretty soon. And some people find it offensive. I find it very helpful. Jung refuses to accept atheism and refuses to accept literal religious statements. And you might say, well, isn't that idolatry, or isn't that cynicism? No. And I'll try to explain why. So given that, then, it opens up the possibility of asking the question, so what is God? Well, remember, we can't know. But what we can do, and here is, I think, another point of Jung's, each epoch has to redefine what God is. Because since we don't know what God is, we're left with our understanding of God. And the nature of the relation of that understanding to the needs of the time has to change, because the times are changing. Now, again, theologians will have a cow over this, but I don't see how you can go any other way. As soon as you say, this is God, you're stuck. If you say, this is my experience of God, then you're open for dialogue.
Is there a school of theology that follows this way of thinking?
You know, I'm sort of out of touch. I really don't know. It'd be interesting to have a theologian respond to that. I don't think any of the mainstream, you know, like Tillich or Whitehead, any of those guys, as far as I know, no. But who knows in the more, you know, marginal, as of yet, unrecognized.
The CTS might be able to answer that.
They might be able to answer that.
There's a philosophy called process philosophy.
Oh, yeah,
Bill
I know
Chris
that one.
Is on that, and it's right in this.
Is it very... Is
they
it,
teach it.
Right.
Several classes of CTS.
And if you read all Catherine Keller's work is based on this idea. It's the movement of a mythic imagination, basically. So God is always in process of becoming. Is the idea. But,
yeah.
And in myth, that's what we study. I mean, what you're describing, we uh-huh. call it the movement of mythic imagination.
Yeah.
So when monotheism came in, God became everything that wasn't dark. Where in the polytheistic period, dark was considered generative and part of mm-hmm. the God. So
yeah, yeah.
it's that movement of this mythic
yeah,
imagination.
That's what's going on.
That he really just keyed in on.
Yeah. And what we'll see then... In his material, in Jung's material, is, from his point of view, from my point of view, how the psyche is helping us to redefine what God is. To come up with an understanding of God that is relevant to the needs of our time. Never saying it's final, never saying it is what God is, but saying as the best we can conceive it, from input from the collective unconscious in this period of breakdown, we're getting a new understanding of what God is. And so he writes, by the way, what this where this stuff comes from, Jung's later thoughts about this material are embedded in his letters. And unfortunately, they are spread all throughout those two volumes. There's no one place. What Edinger has done in this book, The New God Image, is go through those letters and pick out the ones that are most important for this discussion and organize them. And interestingly, as we'll see, I can't imagine it was planned because Edinger, you know, no one read this stuff. Except for very few in the family, I read this Red Book stuff prior to its being published. But Edinger's cataloging of the development of Jung's ideas exactly follows the development of those ideas in the text. So I'll try to point that up to you if you want to read further for your own edification. So Jung writes, man's relation to God probably has to undergo a certain important change. Instead of the propitiating praise to an unpredictable king or the child's prayer to a loving father, the responsible living and fulfilling of the divine will on us will be our form of worship of and commerce with God. So it's redefining what worship is. Worship isn't child to threatening parent, which is the unpredictable king. Or child to nourishing parent, which is the loving father. In other words, the old theology is based on God being a parent and the individual being a child. And so what we're doing is shifting from a child-parent relationship to an adult-adult relationship. What is a religiosity that is not infantile? As far as Jung's concerned, I don't think he ever says it directly, but the implication is all of theology up to now has been infantile. With the exception, maybe, of the prophets. So if our relationship to God isn't praying to God for help, or if it isn't being good for fear of punishment, what is it then? Well, the answer is each of us has been given a task and a work, and fulfilling that is at the same time fulfilling the will of God. So it turns worship into the activity of fulfilling your own life. And that fulfilling your own life doesn't mean fulfilling your ego's ambitions, but fulfilling another experience within yourself. What is that other experience? Well, that's the business of these visions. Okay, so far?
I just have a clarifying.
Yeah.
So working with the individual unconscious, you would be possibly making a God image that is relevant to you. And then working with the collective unconscious is working with a God image that's relevant to the time.
Almost. I think the first part of your question, I'd have to say, there is no such thing as working with your own personal unconscious and forming an image of God. This process of the evolution of our understanding of God is a process common to all people. It's a collective process. Now, each individual gets their version of it. And then, you know, Jung has been attacked for what's called solipsistic religion. Oh, Jung, you're just saying everybody finds their own particular image of God. He said, no. Where we are now is we each are getting a different piece of that new God image. So in each individual seeking to understand how the collective unconscious is speaking to them personally, each person is getting a view on a multifaceted, one facet of a multifaceted reality. And in the long run, if religion is going to have social value again, all those experiences will be pulled. But where we are now, yes, it's an individual struggle with the collective process. And again, this ticks off theologians. I think Jung's answer is basically too bad. Because the old one is, and that is always a point for Jung, the war, two wars, showed it doesn't work. It's not that we had war in spite of our image of God. We had war because of our image of God. That really gets them upset.
And yet at one time in history, say the Crusades, that God image supported those wars.
In a way, it was very much the same, except the difference now is now we're getting upset about it. So you see, consciousness has developed to the point where we can see the inadequacy of the old God image. And really, you know, if you read the Old Testament, what happened in World War II isn't all that much different than what happened in Canaan. You know, the Israelites go into Canaan, and Yahweh says, you see those Canaanites? Kill them. Well, what's that but Auschwitz? And it didn't bother anybody then. But it bothers us now because our level of moral consciousness has developed for a whole variety of reasons, which is forcing us to go back and re-examine our understanding of God as inadequate.
But for that time period, it was adequate? I mean, we can't judge.
Yeah, I don't think we can judge.
We can't take our moral understanding and go back.
It's very hard to take this backwards. I know Edinger's point of view on this is, well, if it happened, it had to happen. I don't know.
Meaning this change in our image of God?
No, that don't cry about spilt milk.
Oh, okay.
That, you know, we can go back and say, well, you know, the Crusades, that was wrong, or, you know, this was wrong, the way the Israelites conquered Canaan was wrong. But the fact is, it happened, and what does it matter whether it was right or wrong?
Do you see anything, and this is you personally, that's young, I'm putting it on you, but yeah. Now there's a return, like the Crusades, to religious war.
Yeah, I don't think it's an accident.
Well, I don't think so either, but I wonder, what would you say?
I think it's the Navy. It's the unexamined old God image in one religion fighting the unexamined God image in another religion.
So you feel both sides are fighting a God cause.
A dying cause?
A God cause.
Yeah, oh, without doubt. Without a doubt.
So it's what, Muslim versus?
It's an antiquated understanding of Allah fighting an unantiquated understanding of Yahweh.
What was the first part of that?
An antiquated understanding of Allah fighting an inadequate understanding of Yahweh. That's a whole other kettle of fish.
It just seems to me that while the Allah thing is really there, mm-hmm. I don't see the God thing that much in our society, in the this side.
Well, both George Bush and Tony Blair said they knew from prayer that they were doing the right thing.
I was excluding them.
Oh, well, they just happened to have orchestrated the war.
Those who are fighting them.
And, you know, and they, I wish I would have saved the reference, but I know I read it, that when we first went into Afghanistan and the Al-Qaeda were fleeing, they found diaries of the fleeing soldiers in which they recounted dreams of Allah appearing to them and saying, "You must destroy the United States. It is purely a religious phenomenon." And I think it is for us too.
The third whatever. There's a cold. I can't remember. It's the first, the second, and this is the third. And this is one where they want to conquer the world.
I don't know Islam that well, but yeah, I think definitely. And, you know, just a quick, we could spend hours on this, but just a quick thing, what has impressed me so much, if, I don't know if you've read the Dream Analysis Seminar, but in that dream, one of the guy's dreams is the union of the cross and the crescent. And that was 1910. So I think it's this war thing, this war we're living out, it has a very strong archetypal basis.
Is there, are we keeping politics separate from us?
But see, the archetypal shift is what politics is based on. It's determining our thinking. We think it's an economic war or whatever, but that's simply our interpretation of being moved by forces we don't understand. That's an opinion. I don't know whether it's fact or not, but that's my working hypothesis.
So that's you, as far as the political?
Yeah. Okay, so far. Now it gets a little more complicated. So how do we know what the divine will is for our life? So we go from the projected view of God as needed to collapse to another understanding of God, which is the fulfilling of your destiny, you might put it. You could almost substitute divine will and destiny. So how do you do it? Now he wrote this next letter to, I think it was Arvind Vasavada, who was up in Chicago. He's dead now. He was a Hindu analyst. And Vasavada wrote Jung a letter and began it, "O exalted master." And then here comes Jung's response. "You seem to be interested in how to get back to the self instead of looking for what the self wants you to do in the world." So you see, what the self wants you to do in the world is the new religious task. It's the new understanding of religion. Does that make sense? "Where, for the time being at least, we are located, presumably for a certain purpose. So the fulfilling of our purpose becomes our worship. The universe does not seem to exist for the sole purpose of man denying or escaping it." So he's responding to Vasavada's Hinduism. Now comes the more direct answer to the question. I don't look back to the self, but collect it out of manifold experiences and put it together again. So in other words, if you want to know what your purpose in life is, of course we work with dreams, but also we have to look at what crosses our path in reality, daily, because it also contains information concerning who we are. And I think that is a very critical point. In other words, you see, the spirit is no longer spiritual only. In a way that I realize raises a lot of questions, daily life is the mass. Daily, yeah, daily life is that place where we meet the will of God hidden in the symbolic meaning of certain events.
That sounds like
Pierre de Chardin.
He
I don't think he fashioned any of this in relation to Teilhard, but I know he liked Teilhard's work very much. Yeah. Except Teilhard didn't live his own work, because he had women falling all over him, and if he was so interested in what God was saying, he might have thought one of those women had something to tell him something. And he ended up in despair. Yeah. This is not an easy road. Because you have to look at your eros, your resentments, the events in your life, and ask yourself, is this here to teach me something?
Is the mass what you would call secular, or?
Well, I think it's neither. The example I've given, maybe here, or I don't remember, but is which I've seen in working with, as they call themselves, recovering Catholics.
Are there any in this room?
No, probably not. Or recovering Methodists meet. They want to, they long for the Mass like you'd long for a lover. They mope around because they can't go back to the church because they can't stomach all the idiotic things that come out of the papacy. But yet they long for it. And they're really suffering. And what happens when we get to working on this and they start making progress in the outer world with fulfilling their meaning, they dream they're in the Mass.
That's part of the recovery.
That is their recovery. Because they have the experience they've been longing for in the way they live. And that is symbolized in the dreams by them being in the Mass. So you could say the world becomes their altar. And the transubstantiation is their taking their knowledge of themselves and living it out.
That should be in the next book.
We'll see. Let's see if I survive this last one. Okay. That's that really important sentence, which is going to appear in the text in a way that's not so clear. Here I think it's a little clearer. That the guidance comes to us in the events of life, or you could say that the events of life are symbols of our purpose. Or another way to say that is, in the events of life, God's will is hidden. If you know how to work with it. What I have left behind, seemingly lost, I meet in everything that comes my way, and I collect it, reassembling as it were. Okay, all these sentences are loaded. Jung's idea, you know, is you're born with a purpose, which lives in you as a child, but you lose it. And life is a series of events trying to recreate that first knowledge of who you are. So these events that come to you in the present and future with a meaning are simply replays of what you once were but have lost. Okay? In order to get rid of opposites, I needs must accept them first. But this leads away from the self. So the way the self presents itself is in conflicts that you meet when you start taking your experience seriously. So you meet somebody, you're attracted to them, you're married, you're in a mess. But that, each of these emotionally charged experiences is trying to tell you something. But often the way it tells you is by presenting you these experiences which are at the same time conflicts. And Jung is saying, and we've got to accept them.
We accept the conflict.
Yeah. And then the idea he's working with is if you accept it, you start a divine process which will resolve them. But you can't get that resolution until you've accepted the things that need to be resolved. So there's this destiny, this purpose, this fulfilling the will of God is manifest to you most deeply in that voice that resolves the conflicts you've accepted by taking your experience seriously. See, what he's doing, he's taking God as something in heaven and putting it as something that's on the earth, in the earth, within our experiences of earthly life.
See, can I give you the question? If someone were an alcoholic, so that's their problem.
Right.
It's not just a matter of accepting, okay, I'm an alcoholic, that then God can guide them.
Well, it would be looking at why they're an alcoholic, which they can't do until they've stopped drinking.
Right.
So, in a way, part of this process looks like it takes you away from experience. That's why he says, have to forget the self. But once you have stabilized, then I think this process applies to look at the experience that comes to you in life, and you can be sure what you'll be dealing with is a lot of difficult emotions, which is why you drank in the first place. And then that's where this would apply.
So is it out of those opposites and engaging that conflict that the transcendent function is activated in?
Right.
Is that God?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, again, remember that's God, but we always have to remember how he defines
it. It's a process.
Yeah.
Okay.
He uses the word, instead of God, God image.
Okay.
But yes, that's the God image.
Okay. And that's what resolves the conflict. And that's what activates the conflict. It's only activated through the conflict.
Right.
Okay.
So see, the spirit, so to speak, only comes through the activated suffering when dealing with the world. And something else I wanted to say.
Sorry.
No, in response to what you said. I forget. It'll come back.
Gary, yeah. Does he ever talk about knowing or manifesting the God image through something other than suffering? In other words, can it come through experiences of joy?
I think it can come through experiences of joy, but without a previous dark night, I think he'd say it's not. You know, it's hard to, I don't want to judge. I think you would say it's likely not to have reached the depths that it can.
It's like, how could you know joy if you don't know?
That's another way to put it, yeah. Yeah.
And that was in the image of the foxglove that Carol pointed out, that that's digitalis, which is a drug that we still use that is one of the... if children get a hold of it, it is very lethal because their little healthy hearts, it stops them. But in someone with an old, broken heart that doesn't work very well, it's a medicine. So it's
a very good way to put it.
It's a medicine at sometimes, it's a poison at other times, depending on the condition of the heart.
See, that is exactly true for this relationship to this experience, that it, on the one hand, it looks very toxic, and it is toxic to a weak ego. But if your heart's in the right place, and you see the care, you know, Jung gave to this inner work, he wasn't saying, well, gosh, I don't think I'll do my inner work today, I'll go play tennis or whatever. If you approach it with a frivolous attitude, this confrontation with the unconscious can be highly destructive. But if you can approach it with the right attitude, then it can become your saving grace, just like that plant.
This is where I think the image of from the Secret of the Golden Flower is so important, to that, you know, we have these fragmented parts, we come together, and yet we're also a fragmented part in the collective.
Yeah,
right?
Both are true. Okay. We're going to start out, we're going to be working with both of those levels the whole time. The relationship between the individual healing themselves and what that means for a greater healing of our times. Remember, we're dealing with the spirit of the times and the spirit of the depths.
You know, I'm just worried about what you said, that you said we're more conscious now. In the old days, when the Israelis murdered people, nobody cared, but now you said we're more conscious. I'm still right there. I don't know if we are or not.
Well, some people are.
Yeah, okay.
Nations aren't.
Yeah.
But I think voices are. And in a way, I think you could say, probably even in, I don't know about I think even in the Crusades, there were rioters, you know, protesting. Certainly there were, the prophets were protesting. But it's like, how much of that took hold in the society? I'd like to think it is progressively finding a wider appeal. I think that's enough of that passage. Give you the idea how we go from a theory of knowledge to changing the parent-child nature of our relationship to God, to understanding, fulfilling our meaning is our religious task, to finding the utter importance of conflict in life for teaching us that purpose. So I know it sounds weird, but that suggests that those events in life have a sort of intelligence. Or there is an intelligence embedded somewhere. mean, it's a weird idea, but that's the conclusion we're forced to reach. Okay, that's... one more. This is all Jung Religion 101. The last little quote there on page 229 in the sheet. The subsequent stage of religious thought is always the interpretation on a subjective stage. Does that make any sense?
Not at all.
Here's the idea. That going now, building on what we've said, a religious system is a psychological creation based, no doubt, on, as far as Jung is concerned, on a genuine and religious experience. But then that the nature of religious experience being that is conditioned by the human process of perception. The religious system that responds to that experience is a statement of the psychology that receives it. So, every religion is a portrait of the psychology of the people who receive that experience. It is not objectively, metaphysically true. It is psychologically true. And as the needs of the individual society, or let's say as the needs of the society or the evolution of history changes, a new system of receiving and understanding religious experience has to be created. And then what one realizes in that recreation is that the old system is pure psychology. And we can integrate it just like we integrate a dream. That's where we are now in history. Christianity is now in a position to be integrated, to be seen on the subjective level. That is, it is not a description of God, it's a description of who we are. And where we are now is fashioning another understanding of what religion is, what God is, which will work for a time as a viewpoint we can live in. And then 500 years from now, our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandchildren will realize, oh, that is pure psychology. So that's how religion evolves for Jung. A system is believed in, it's come to be doubted, it needs to be interpreted, and then a new understanding of what that God is can appear. Like, you know, we talk about your Zeus energy, your Aphrodite energy. We are now able to see Greek religion on the subjective stage. You probably wouldn't get very far in most churches talking about your Yahweh energy or your Mary energy or your Herod energy. See, that's truth. But that's as much a psychological truth as Greek religion is. It's just, if you're contained in it, you can't interpret it. But for those who have lost belief in it, it becomes available for psychological interpretation. Not to say, and here is where Jung is not on the same wavelength as the existentialist, not to say that's all God is. That's just the paradigm through which God has been expressed or understood. And what the religious task is, when the old system is seen to be inadequate, as the previous system was because of the ineffectiveness of religion for stopping the two world wars, that system collapses, but that doesn't mean that God doesn't exist. That just means the way God has been formulated is inadequate. But the European solution, largely at the end of the wars, was, well, that means there's no God. And you can say, oh, it doesn't mean that. It means that the way God has been framed is inadequate. And in a way, it really does make a difference, because once you lose your belief system, you still have to go through a dark night of the soul. and find another system that works.
What about the fundamentals to gone backward?
Well, as far as Jung's concerned, that's pure historical regression.
So, why put it?
Because what happens when that old system is seen as inadequate, a terrific period of confusion sets in. I think it's the same feeling whether you're saying God is dead or whether you're saying my religious views are dead. It's a terrible time, and the ego is too weak in many instances to sustain that transformation, and when it is too weak, it just believes in the old all the more strongly. Well, that's the basic. We'll look at the text. Hopefully that will help you grasp the text. Let's take a break.